the person that you read that Bowser, what was his last name? The bio that you just read.
Bowser,
okay. I remember reading about him. Yeah. That's creative, Walter. That's definitely creative. It's kind of interesting talking about ministry's not pretty. And something that Walter said yesterday as he was during the introduction, did you guys catch? He said, when I was in jail and the alarms went off. Yeah. Well, ministry's definitely not jail. I assume after listening to you for a while that you were there as a chaplain, you weren't in the clink because of...
Doing a Bible study, yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's amazing how that happens. Kelvin Hoover... who is not here today. They're interviewing a minister, potential minister there in Livingston, Montana. But Kelvin had a lesson that he shared at the Yellowstone Bible Camp this last year. And he had a couple things that he said in that lesson that he had to talk through afterwards with people, because he made a comment about how his daughter just moved up to Alaska and got pregnant up there. And he forgot, he didn't mention that she was married and her and her husband both moved up there together. And then he was mentioned when he moved back to Montana and he was living on the wine glass. And if you don't know Livingston, Sean, what's the wine glass? It's a mountain range. Okay. And so he was living out on that outside of Livingston. People say they're living on the wine glass, and that's not what people understood. So, some talking to do afterwards, and boy, ministry can sure not be pretty. And we're going to walk through that. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 is where we're going to be at some today. But I wanted to share one thing as well. One of the guys that was here last year from Montana, Russell Epperson, he is, just wanted to share some hellos from him. I talked with him last night for a bit, and he is he's been through some tough moments in the church there in Lewistown. And so if you have received nasty letters from people or anything, you can talk with me. I'll share some of why that's happened or whatever. But anyway, it's just it's an unfortunate situation, but God is working and doing amazing stuff there. And sometimes there's pruning that happens or whatever, but there's if you have Russell's number, if you don't, you can get it from me or one of the Montana guys, and you're welcome to just send him a text message and say, hey, I'm praying for you, thinking about you, and I think that would mean a whole lot to him right here at this point in time. And so there is, as we go into talk about how ministry is not pretty, I mean, there's lots of different directions we can go with that. But I looked at the context to see what's Paul talking about as far as ministry is not pretty. And all sorts of different ways that we can go there. There was it you, Walter, that read? Someone read 1 Corinthians 6 where it talks about this is what some of you were, and it goes down through a laundry list of those sins and stuff. And I looked at that list and I thought, well, I've had people confess every one of those to me in my context this week, I think. I might have to stretch back a couple weeks, but there we are. It's messy, it's not pretty. But what Paul's talking about in this context is his own working throughs of what he's had to, the burdens that he's had to carry, the hardships that he's had. And so we're going to walk through that here in a second. But I want to go ahead and hit the space bar. Okay, how many of you are familiar with demotivators? Okay, some of you? Okay, motivators are those things you see in offices where those posters, they have a black border, and they say something that is supposed to lift the morale of everybody, and demotivators do the opposite. It's just dark humor, is what it is. And I appreciate dark humor for a lot of reasons, just not evil, but just... Okay, I'm going to have to back up on this. You guys know what I'm talking about here, okay?
Yes.
Is that that's part of a coping mechanism for people who work in ERs or whatever, is you learn to joke about things that really aren't funny at all, but it's part of that coping mechanism. And mm-hmm. So, here, mistakes. It could be that the purpose of your life is only to serve as a warning to others. Okay, let's go next. Next. All right, tradition. Just because you've always done it that way doesn't mean it's not incredibly stupid. Running with the bulls in Pamplona. Yep, bad idea. Next. Potential. Not everyone gets to be an astronaut when they grow up. Sometimes we just have to settle for something else. Go ahead, Walter. Ambition, a journey of 1,000 miles sometimes ends very, very badly. There are not always happy endings after all the work that we put in. It just doesn't always work that way. Okay, next. Go ahead. Okay, perseverance, the courage to ignore the obvious wisdom of turning back. Sometimes that's important. Look at the next one here. All we ask here is that you give us your heart.
Hey, Chris, I'm going to turn that light off.
Oh, I just turned that light off. Oh, is that better? Okay. I remember discovering this years ago, and I've never done it, but I've sometimes wondered, I should frame this and put it in my office at the church building. Because this is, it's funny, but it's kind of not. And the idea being, there's this Aztec or Mayan temple, whatever it is, where they have human sacrifices, and all we ask around here is that you give us your heart. And that is maybe part of the reason that the ministry's not pretty. It's tough. You have to walk through a lot of really tough life situations with people, and all the while trying to keep ourselves healthy in the process. And give and give and give and trying to find where that balance is and how to try to take care of our families and all of that. And there's sometimes where I think every one of us feel, whether we're in supported ministry, we serve as an elder, or we have some ministry that we take on in the church, that I've given so much of myself. Does anybody even realize that? And I feel like around here, all they're asking is my heart, you know, just to rip it out of me and someone take it. And this is, it's a tough place to be. And so Paul understood that. You read through 2 Corinthians, what we're looking through this week, and there's a lot of this you can hear, you can sense from Paul. And so let's go to chapter 6. I'm going to read through parts of this, and we'll comment on it. I want to hear from you guys. And then we're going to look at a couple of examples of people who served in ministry well. And even though it wasn't pretty, even though it was tough, they did some amazing things. And these two people have been great examples for me. But look at chapter 6. We're going to start in verse 4. He says, "Rather, as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, in great endurance, in troubles, hardships, and distresses, in beatings, imprisonments, and riots, in hard work, sleepless nights, and hunger." Okay, go ahead and hit the button, Walter. So here's, Paul lists out, here are some of these things or ways that I've experienced personal discomfort. And look at those again. Let's list them off. Endurance, had to have great endurance. Troubles, hardships, distresses, beatings, imprisonments, riots, hard work, sleepless nights, and hunger. Wow. Okay, all of those things there. Kind of sounds like military, doesn't it, Gary? I look at that, it sounds, you know, kind of similar. What would you add? Hey, Paul gives just one word, obstacles that he's had to overcome as he is trying to serve God in ministry. What are some other descriptive terms that you would use? Okay, no editorials, just descriptive terms. That hardships, personal discomfort, the ways that you've experienced that. What do you think?
Durability,
okay. What else?
Poverty?
Scott?
No. In Canada.
Loneliness? Oh, yeah. What else? Say again?
Betrayal?
Yeah.
Frustration. Somebody else wanted me to say elders' meetings.
Somebody else wanted me to say elders' meetings. Jerry?
I second it, though.
Perils. Okay. Yeah, perils.
Immaturity?
Okay. Mm-hmm. What else?
Time constraints.
Mm-hmm. Discouragement.
Okay.
Loss of focus.
Apathy.
Yeah. Yep. All of those things.
Joys.
What's that?
Occasional joys.
Okay. Yeah. Occasional joys. Occasional instead of all the time, right? Right. Yeah. Okay. there's a lot of that we could go through there of that list of experiencing personal discomfort. Okay, Paul, this is not an exhaustive list, but Paul gives us something. What's up, Alan?
I have another one. You know, keep it in your prayers, just getting home, being stuck in bus depot.
Yeah, that's
after being sick last week.
Yeah, that's an obstacle. Absolutely. Bus depots in America, that'll do it. So all these personal discomforts, and this is an exhaustive list, we come up with many, many more of ways that we experience personal discomfort. But look at verse 6, he continues, he switches gears here, and he talks about something different. In purity, understanding, patience, and kindness, in the Holy Spirit, and in sincere love, and truthful speech, and in the power of God, with weapons of righteousness in the right hand and the left, through glory and dishonor. We'll come back to that here in just a second. But he talks about using these weapons of righteousness. And when others play dirty, it's really hard, I find it really hard, to find great comfort in saying, well, at least I'm pursuing purity and understanding and patience and kindness. And the Holy Spirit, I know He's powerful, but I just don't feel it right now. And truthful speech. Wait a minute, how come others get to play nasty and I don't? This, I feel like I'm at a real disadvantage here, and this doesn't seem like this is a... How does this work? And I'm sure Paul felt that tension. He's writing about it here. Let's continue on. Verse 8. Through glory and dishonor, bad report and good report, genuine yet regarded as impostors, known yet regarded as unknown, dying and yet we live on, beaten and yet not killed, sorrowful yet always rejoicing, poor yet making many rich, having nothing and yet possessing everything. And we could back up and take some time and go through all of those. You know, having nothing yet possessing everything, having not being wealthy in this world, but because we're children of God, all of it's ours anyway. And all of that, you look at it and think, man, here is this the description of this great ministry roller coaster, where there's these great highs that we feel like, man, there's some amazing things that are happening. Look at what God has done. This is phenomenal. I can see this. I can feel the call of God here. And then other times think, what on earth did I sign up for? This is not what I wanted. This is not my dreams. This is not my and wrestle there. And Paul is sharing that roller coaster here, enduring the highs and lows. And so those are some of the things he shares there. Just this is part of why ministry is not pretty, is that there's personal discomfort comes from it. I feel like we're disadvantaged when we're dealing with people that are not playing according to God's rules and enduring these highs and lows and such like that. And I put one more down there, is people. Sometimes I am just, I don't know, there's just when I think that there's not going to be anything surprise me regarding the crazy factor of people, somehow I'm shocked at, you know, what my perception someone else is capable of doing. It's like, how on earth is that? Did you just do that? I can't believe that had happened. Did you just stir the pot like that, or whatever it may be? You know, you all know what I'm talking about. Is those situations where you're sitting with someone and you're thinking, are we really talking about this? I have no idea how on earth reason enters into this discussion whatsoever. Or someone that you've invested a ton of time in, seems to be doing well, and then just on a dime, self-destructs, and they run after something sinful that's destructive for them, and you see it coming from 100 miles away, and there's no way you can turn from it. You think, what on earth? The crazy factor is off the chart here, and what is causing these people to do this? And when I look at this list here, experiencing personal discomfort, use weapons of righteousness, not playing in the same ways that everybody else is, enduring highs and lows, I look at that and I think, man, that is, you know, I mentioned to Gary here just a second ago, that's sort of what military life is like, ups and downs and all of this. But I would, maybe let's go a step further. When you look at the things that Paul talks about, troubles, beatings, hardships, distresses, all of that sort of thing, highs and lows, think, man, you know, what causes someone like these suicide bombers to say, hey, I'm going to sign up for that, I'm going to do this, I'm going to put myself through all sorts of hard life situations and live outside the margins of society and strap a bomb to myself and run into a building and blow it up. What on earth causes a person to do something like that, be so dedicated to a life of that is so atypical, to do something like that? And I kept coming back to and thinking about is that when people believe in a cause and a mission, they're capable of doing anything.
That's right.
And there's a few people that keep coming back in Scripture, and there's many, many more that we can look at. And let's go to Jeremiah. Go ahead, Walter, you can punch the magic button. Let's go to Jeremiah. In Jeremiah, in chapter 1, we see his call. And I'm going to read portions of this here, and then I'll talk about it as we go through. But Jeremiah is called by God to serve during a time where he experiences all these things that Paul talks about. Chapter 1, verse 4, it says, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. Alas, sovereign God, I said, I don't know how to speak. I'm too young. But the Lord said to me, do not say, I'm too young. You must go to everyone I send you and say whatever I command you. Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you and I will rescue you, declares the Lord. Then the Lord reached out his hand and touched my mouth and said to me, I have put my words in your mouth. See, today I appoint you over nations and kingdoms to uproot and tear down, to destroy and overthrow, to build and to plant." And so Jeremiah is saying, I don't know how to do this. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do here. I can't speak. God says, I'm going to be with you, but I'm going to place you over nations. Hey, you are going to be the one who is going to speak my words to people. You're going to be a powerful, powerful individual. And skip over to verse 17. It says, God says, "Get yourself ready, stand up and say to them whatever I command you. Do not be terrified by them, or I will terrify you before them. Today I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but will not overcome you. For I am with you, and I will rescue you, declares the Lord." And here is the call of Jeremiah, is I am going to send you into places that are tough and dangerous, and I'm going to be with you. Just be courageous. And my impression is what we see from Jeremiah, and you go along, is that this wasn't Jeremiah, was not born with this courageous streak that he was just going to run into, you know, whatever danger there would be, and that was just natural for him. It took prompting from God to put him in these places. And this is this call here. Look at chapter 7. Let's fast forward to chapter 7. Verses 27, 28. Jeremiah 7, 27, 28. It says, "When you tell them all this, they will not listen to you. When you call them, they will not answer. Therefore say to them, this is a nation that has not obeyed the Lord its God or responded to correction. Truth has perished. It has vanished from their lips." So God tells Jeremiah, what you're going to do is you're going to go and you're going to speak to all these people, and they're not going to listen to you. And who wants to sign up for that?
No.
Yeah, how would that be in the Christian Chronicle? You're reading a job description in the ministry section, and the church says, we want someone to come that's going to be courageous, that is going to speak to the words of God, speak to us the words of God, knowing full well that we have no intention whatsoever of listening to them. Man, skip to chapter 20 of Jeremiah. Chapter 20, verses 1 and 2. I'll actually just start reading in 2 there. What happens is Jeremiah speaks, he's speaking there. And they have, now Pashur, the official there, has Jeremiah the prophet beaten and put in the stocks in the upper gate of Benjamin at the Lord's temple. So they're at the temple, this place that is supposed to, where people come and hear the message of God. Jeremiah speaks the message of God and he's put in stocks there. He's released the next day. But look at verses 7 through 18. And here you see the heart of Jeremiah, and what you'll see is him going back and forth and back and forth, from courage to frustration to courage to frustration and back. In verse 7, it says, "You deceived me, Lord, and I was deceived." In other words, you tricked me. "You overpowered me and prevailed. I am ridiculed all day long. Everyone mocks me. Whenever I speak, I cry out, proclaiming violence and destruction. So the word of the Lord has brought me insult and reproach all day long. But if I say, I will not mention his word or speak anyone anymore in his name, his word is in my heart like a fire shut up in my bones. I am weary of holding it in. Indeed, I cannot. I hear many whispering, terror on every side. Denounce him. Let's denounce him. All my friends are waiting for me to slip, saying, perhaps he will be deceived. Then we will prevail over him and take our revenge on him. But the Lord is with me like a mighty warrior. So my persecutors will stumble and not prevail. They will fail and be thoroughly disgraced. Their dishonor will never be forgotten. Lord Almighty, you who examine the righteous and probe the heart and mind, let me see your vengeance upon them. For to you I have committed my cause. Sing to the Lord. Praise to the Lord. He rescues the life of the needy from the hands of the wicked. So it sounds like Jeremiah has turned. And it's like, all right, I understand, God, you tricked me. I get it. But I know you're going to take care of me. I know you're going to bring justice on my part. And then verse 14, cursed be the day that I was born. May the day my mother bore me not be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought my father the news, who made him very glad, saying, a child is born to you, a son. May that man be like the towns the Lord overthrew without pity. May he hear wailing in the morning, a battle cry at noon. For he did not kill me in the womb, with my mother as my grave, her womb enlarged forever. Why did I ever come out of the womb to see trouble and sorrow and end my days in shame? Here's Jeremiah really wrestling here with what God is, the mission that God has given him. And he knows the right answers, but man, in his heart he's frustrated and it hurts, and his friends are betraying him. Betrayal like that is one of the most painful things that we experience. But I want to go ahead and punch the magic button, Walter. Something Jeremiah says there in the middle of all this. Sometimes I say to myself, I will not remember him or speak to him, speak anymore in his name. But when I say that, his word burns in my heart like fire. It feels like it's burning deep in my bones, and I can't hold it in any longer. I've got to speak. And I can relate to Jeremiah in that. I think probably all of us can, because when there's a call of God to serve in ministry, supported ministry, elders, deacons, whatever it may be, way of serving in the church, you understand that burden. Because Jeremiah felt this great burden, God gave him this great mission, and he could not help but do it. Couldn't help but do it. He's just going to do it, even though it's painful, even though it's frustrating, even though it's not what he signed up for, not what he wanted, not his dreams of life. He said, I cannot not do this, because it's like this fire in me and I can't extinguish it. And that's what call of God does, is it places that fire in us somewhere, somehow, that we know that we will never, ever, ever find contentment, fulfillment in this life unless we do something, that whatever it is that God's calling us. We just got to do it. Let's look at another guy. Let's go back to Nehemiah. Nehemiah is one that I've spent in the last couple of years quite a bit of time in Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, unlike Jeremiah, experiences, as we can tell, no vision from God, no clear call, as we would call it, to this specific ministry. But when you read through the first little bits here, what we see very clearly from Nehemiah is that he has this burden in his heart that he's got to do something. I'll start in verse 2. Hananiah, one of the brothers, came from Judah and with some other men. I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province, are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept, and for some days I mourned and fasted before the Lord, before the God of heaven. So it doesn't appear that God appears to Nehemiah and says, Nehemiah, you're going to go back and build that wall. But somewhere, God placed this burden deep in him, and he can't shake it. And you read through his prayer there, his prayer is pouring out this dissatisfaction that the wall is broken down and things are not going well back in Jerusalem. Now, Nehemiah had it pretty well, serving as the cupbearer to the king. He's faithful, his good graces with the king. He could have stayed there, could have been comfortable, could have done his thing. people would have spoken well of him, I'm sure, of what a great servant he was and that. But if you go to chapter 2, I'll start reading in verse 1. It says, "The month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought before him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, 'Why does your face look so sad when you're not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart.' I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?' And the king said to me, 'What is it you want?' Then I prayed to the God of heaven," maybe the shortest prayer in scripture, "and I answered the king, 'If it pleases the king and your servant, if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it.' Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, 'How long will your journey take and when will you get back?' It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time." And for the rest of the book of Nehemiah, what we see is that Nehemiah has got this call and this mission. My job is to go back and to call people back to God. But Nehemiah is not a scholar. It doesn't appear. He's not a priest. But he can rebuild the wall. He knows how to do that. He can motivate people. He can accomplish this. And he goes back. And it's amazing. The people, when you walk through the book of Nehemiah, he has opposition from the outside. There's all sorts of people that from the outside, some Arabs, and are trying to stir the pot to make trouble for him. And they have friends and relatives that are Jewish because there's been some intermarriage there. And so they're doing whatever they can to give Nehemiah grief. And Nehemiah just stays the course. He does not allow them to knock him off his mark. And he just continues to fulfill this mission of building the wall. But not only that, is there's opposition from the inside. There's the Jews themselves, the wealthy Jews, are charging interest and keeping their poorer brothers in slavery, basically. Nehemiah says, not okay, not all right. And there's opposition from that. You get to chapter 13, there's a bunch of opposition that happens from Nehemiah's own people. And so Nehemiah has this call of God that burns in him, and he has opposition from the outside, opposition from the inside, but Nehemiah continues on, no matter what. And notice, go ahead and hit the button again, Walter. It says, here's a few different passages, and you see things like this all throughout Nehemiah. It says, "They were trying to frighten us, thinking, 'Their hands will get too weak for the work, and it will not be completed.' But I prayed, 'Now strengthen my hands.'" You know, one time there was came to Nehemiah and said, "Hey, you need to run to the temple. You need to hide because someone's trying to harm you." Nehemiah, he does that. He shows everybody that he's afraid. Says, a person like me cannot do something like that. Chapter 13, verse 14, he says, "Remember me for this, my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services." And in that, you see that Nehemiah does not quit. He just continues on. He continues to be courageous. And I ask why. Why is he able to do that? Because Nehemiah had a very clear call from God that placed deep in his heart, had a mission that he was not going to give up on. Mm-hmm. And he was going to pursue that. I think about, there's one person that comes to mind. I think about, you know, an example with Nehemiah, modern-day Nehemiah in some ways. How many of you know who Charles Scott is? Bess Schrader's father. If you know Bess Schrader, she's part of the church in Belgrade. Mm-hmm. Her father, she told me a story. I had no idea about Charles Scott and what... I knew he had spent time in India and he'd done some different things. But really, pretty fascinating story, because Beth said when she was a little girl, they lived in Tennessee, and I don't remember the name of the town, but it was where DuPont, a big factory, was. And that factory had a very high standard for workers. There was all sorts of moral codes and such. And she said, my dad was the preaching minister of a church of 900 people. And there were people, it was a nice life. And my dad could have stayed there. The elders wanted him to stay there. It was going well. And it was just, you know, all these perfect people that were down there in a perfect place. And we had this perfect life. And my dad ended up taking this car trip and ended up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And he said, there's no church here. This place is a mess. I'm going to leave everything and move my family up here, and we're going to plant a church here. And that's what he did. And that's how Beth grew up in that context. And that's why she said, I will never, ever, under any circumstance, marry a minister. She married Mike, and then Mike went back to preaching school and became a minister. And it's just, yeah, and Beth is, you know, her struggle through that is very insightful if you've never heard that. But you know, what an example. Now, Nehemiah could have stayed, been comfortable, all that sort of stuff, and said, no, there's a mission that needs to be done. And I'm going to go do that. Now, Charles Scott, there's still people that do things like that. go ahead and hit the next button here. And so here's a question that I guess it comes down to. Why do ministry when to pursue discomfort, uneven playing field, extreme highs and lows, and whatever else we can, all these things that Paul talks about. Why on earth would a person pursue that? And go back to 2 Corinthians. We're going to read the first few verses of chapter 6. And this is, he tells them why, right before he talks about all the hardships and ups and downs. Chapter 6, verse 1. As God's co-workers, we urge you not to receive God's grace in vain. For he says, in the time of my favor I heard you, in the day of salvation I helped you. I tell you, now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation. So in other words, now is the time to share God's message, favor, and grace. That's the calling and that's the mission that we've been given. Is now is that time. There's people out there that don't know the message of Jesus. And there's people inside our communities that don't know the message of Jesus or not been transformed, whatever. But now is the time. Now is the time to do something about it. And my sense is that people that serve actively in churches, whether supported ministry, vocational ministry, elders, deacons, whatever it may be, have this burden and burn somewhere deep inside saying, someone has to do this stuff. Someone has to share the message of Jesus. Somebody has to go and clean the building and because nobody else is doing it, and we have to have this place looking great when guests come. Somebody has to do this stuff, and I'm going to do it. I'm just going to do it. In verse 3 it says, we put no stumbling block in anybody's path so that our ministry will not be discredited. Stumbling block is not as causing someone to grumble, but causing someone to stumble. Okay, those are different things. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Paul says, is I don't want to put any stumbling block in anybody's path that causes someone to stumble, for their faith to be damaged and hurt. I had I'll share this and I'll come back around to some things that I found to be helpful. There was a contractor here in the context I work in Belgrade. We're mostly blue collar people, contractors, electricians, plumbers, and hardest working people I've ever been around in my life. It's not uncommon for these guys in the church to work 60, 70 hours a week. They're booked out for months right now. Economy's booming. Rich people are spending a lot of money, and so that's in our world. That means a lot of the work is going. And one of them here told me, I tried to start a men's group in the morning and realized I couldn't do that because some of them leave the house at 4 a.m. to get up to their job sites. And I said, well, I don't think that's going to work, fellas. They said, no, we don't either. We need our sleep. But, amen, right?
Yeah.
But one of them mentioned to me, he said, you know, I'm not so excited about being around a bunch of ministers when you guys all get together because you just complain about how tough life is all the time. And I thought, oh man, if that's his impression, and this isn't a complainer, this is a worker, but I think he's just been in situations where he's heard the ministers talk about, oh man, this happened or that happened, or things are tough, things are frustrating, and all that kind of stuff. And ministry is not pretty. Life isn't pretty. But I think what Paul shows us here in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and all throughout 2 Corinthians, if we're going to struggle, we need to struggle well. And that's what Paul does, is he shows his struggles, but he does so in a way that doesn't cause people to stumble, but causes people to grow and go deeper. And I was talking with a friend of mine who's in some spiritual struggles here recently, and I said, man, with the age of your kids, mean, struggle away, but just make sure you struggle well, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to have a major faith crisis, do it before you have kids or after the kids are out of the house, okay? Don't do it now, because something really bad can happen the way your kids just view things, and you know, we laughed about it in that. But Paul struggles all the way through 2 Corinthians. When I read those, it doesn't cause me to want to quit. It causes me to remember what the mission is. In my times of frustration, my times where I feel like, man, why on earth am I doing this? What is this about? Woe is me, all of that sort of thing. It's those times when I forget what the mission is and what the call is. I know that Bruce and I were talking about this last night. I know three times in my life, I believe that God has answered prayers with a call to mission that I cannot explain away in any other way. I know that, and so we've talked about before, that some of you never experienced a call like that. Your call is like Nehemiah's. It's just, hey, I've got this burden, and I got to do something about it, and here I go. And I don't think that I've had these amazing experiences of the call of God because of great faith. I think it's probably the opposite, because I probably just wouldn't do it if I didn't have God in the megaphone screaming at me or something. I don't know how that all works. But anyway, there is a... I've learned, one of the things I've learned a whole lot about just life and ministry here the last while is I've coached soccer for almost 10 years now, because my daughter, we enrolled her in a soccer league when she was 5 years old and there was no one to coach. It's like, well, okay, I'll coach. And I enjoyed it and I loved it. And so I remember the first years of coaching. These kids, they couldn't figure out which direction the soccer goal was. And so I placed a parent with a bag of M&Ms behind the goal. And it worked. And they would go towards that goal, and they knew they got M&Ms if they went towards that goal, not the other one. And just, you know, these little things they figured out along the way. One of, this last year, I coached a team that was a 7th and 8th graders. And I've had... especially in recent years, a lot of success as a coach. Okay, and I'll explain, I think there's two reasons why. Number one, my son is on the team that I coach, and my son plays well, and I think that has something to do with it. That's part of, and so I think me being a good coach, if you have a kid that plays well, then you can be an awesome coach. I mean, it just, it's good. No, but I think the other part of it is, and I have two assistant coaches that were phenomenal this year, 15 7th and 8th graders that we coached. And when I talk to the kids, I talk to the parents, I have a parent meeting to start with, and then I reiterate with the kids all the way through. I say, here's the deal. I've coached for a long time, and you guys have different goals and different things you're going to do in life. Some of you want to play high school soccer, some of you won't. And it's fine, whatever you decide to do, and it's great. And I tell the parents that there's a kid that I played soccer with when I was a kid, that he was always picking dandelions, and he was running off, and he couldn't seem to figure out what was going on in the field. And his parents are always distressed at, oh man, what's our kid, what on earth is wrong with our kid? He's an MD now, okay, so he's fine, all right? There's just, some kids like soccer and some don't, and it's fine. But if we can enrich the kids' lives through the game of soccer, there's really going to be good fruit that comes from that. And what I've seen is I have two rules for the team. We talk about it every time we practice. Pursue excellence in everything. And so when you're practicing, do your best. When you're in the game, do your best. When you're doing homework, do your best. And they say, oh, whatever. When you're at home, do your best to be a good family member. And we talk through this every practice. And rule number two is treat others the way you want to be treated. And I said, if someone misses something or makes a bad pass, you let me be the coach, okay? You guys don't say, what'd you do that for? Okay, you let me do it, because I'll tell you why. Because that person who made the bad pass knows it and does not need reinforcement on that. And you watch it. What's going to happen is the teams that we play, they will bite each other to death, and you guys will take over. Just watch. It's going to happen. And so you guys just keep each other encouraged, and you let me be the coach, you let me make the corrections, and it's all going to work out okay. I never talk about winning. I never talk about the end result. I just talk about the process. Pursuing excellence in everything, treat others the way you want to be treated. And we walk through that. And I'm sure there's coaches that can coach circles around me as far as tactics and all that sort of thing. I run a formation. It's very simple. It's very easy to teach and for kids to grasp and to be able to play. And I'm not a yeller coach. I don't stand on the sidelines and scream this or that. I let them play. And what happens when what I've noticed is as these kids learn to play throughout the season, they start to trust each other, they start to play well together, and they know that if they make a mistake, it's not the end of the world. I'm not going to pull them. They're going to get rotated out, and we'll talk about it, and I'll say, hey, good job, no big deal. And they know that there's a... that I believe in. And the assistant coaches, and they're phenomenal. These two assistant coaches, just phenomenal, phenomenal assistant coaches. But what we saw this year is that there were coaches that I watched a team play that the coach would, what she did is she continually criticized her team, and you could tell that's what was happening. And this team, technique-wise, ability-wise, had lots of opportunities to do great. But they played several levels lower than they should have because they played scared all the time. They played like they were just not going, it wasn't going to work, that they were going to get hollered at, all that kind of thing. And I could just see it, and I thought, oh, those poor girls. There's coaches that will scream and holler about the problem with refs and that, and you see the players start doing that. There's coaches that, and you watch one of the teams that had a yeller coach, and again, the players started playing insecure because they're being overcoached. They're given more than they can handle. But if a coach believes in them and encourages them and says the mission is pursue excellence in everything, treat others the way you want to be treated, don't worry about the score, just let it go, you just play, those teams in kids' soccer are unstoppable. It's amazing to watch them. And I believe the spiritual principle there is that as coaches, all of us, we can't make somebody do anything. We can't, I'd love to step on the field sometimes, but as a coach, they would not let a 43-year-old go out and take a PK at a 7th and 8th grade. You can't do it. And in a lot of ways, the analogy breaks down in some ways, but that's really what we're called to be, is coaches in the churches where we're at, and coaches that help call people higher. And if we believe in people, if we show that we're going to encourage them, we realize the struggle is real, but we struggle well, like Paul talks about here, and we're not willing to give up, and we know that the people know that we have their back, and we're willing to walk with them through whatever, and we focus on the process, pursue excellence in everything, treat others the way you want to be treated. What I see is people come together and turn into something amazing. I've seen it in soccer, I've seen it in churches, and I believe that's a great way for us to view ourselves as coaches that help encourage and call people higher. One more thing. How many of you have heard the podcast Revitalize and Replant? Are you familiar with it? A few of you? I'd recommend, because most all of the churches in this north central region are in that place. We're not church plants anymore. That was decades ago. But Revitalize and Replant. It's Tom Rainer. He's a well-known Southern Baptist scholar. And they don't talk about doctrine much at all. They talk about just nuts and bolts, practical stuff. And some of it is too much towards the attractional side. Probably there's bones to pick out. You'll figure that out. Okay, it's not hard to figure all that out. But Revitalize and Replant, it's a podcast that's designed to encourage church leaders to say, all right, we're living in a country that's full of churches that just need some revitalization. And how do you do that? How do you walk through revitalizing and encouraging churches? And it's really simple, practical stuff. And I'll listen to it for a few months and I won't for a while. And I'll listen to it for a few months and I won't for a while. But one of the things in there that I found to be really helpful, there's a phrase that they use quite a bit. Four things. If you're going to be in a church that needs revitalization, here's four things to consider and to remember and to do these things over and over and over again. Preach, pray, love, and stay. Okay? Preach, pray, love, and stay. And continue to do those things. And for the first 5 years you're in a revitalization, you have no idea what's going on and how it's going. There's no clue to know. But after that, if you do those things, you continue to preach, continue to pray, continue to love people, and you continue to stay, watch for the fruit, because God does amazing things when we approach ministry that way. And so as Paul's hardships, I think he was able to overcome those hardships and frustrations and all of that because he really saw the mission. He really saw the calling, and he never lost sight of that. And when I get frustrated, it's because I'm losing sight of the calling that God has given.
That's right.
And so that's my encouragement to us, is never lose sight of the calling. And when we do wrestle, wrestle well.
Amen.